Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. And this week, I want to thank a handful of you who have visited my Patreon page at patreon.com/talknerdy and pledged your support of the show. It is because of you that Talk Nerdy is 100% free to download for everybody who would like to listen. And you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, and pretty much anywhere else that you can find podcasts through catching the RSS. All right. First, I want to give a huge thank you to Phil T-Bear and Timothy Glover. I sent your goodies in the mail. Hopefully, you will receive them soon. I also want to thank Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. I also want to go down the list and thank a handful of you who have shown your support in small amounts, but, you know, in a really big way over the past several months since I've joined Patreon. I want to thank Warren Rogers. I want to thank Rob Barcy. I really want to thank Christopher Royce, Ryan Schauer, Grant McKinney, Rick Richardson, Giovanni Morales. I want to thank Kyle Bilheimer, Doug Petapier, I think that's right, Anthony Roberts, Juan. I don't know your last name, Juan, but I thank you very much. Really want to thank Ron Kano Block for your incredible support over the past few months. And I want to thank Len Weaver. Thank you so much, you guys. Couldn't do it without you. You are amazing. I also want to encourage anybody who is interested in supporting the show. You can do it in a ton of different ways. You can visit the website, carasantamaria.com. There's a lot of links you can follow there to shop in the store, to give a donation, or tell your friends, tell your family, rate and review on iTunes and Stitcher. Also wanted to let you know that there are opportunities, those two, I guess, but mostly opportunities to support the show through advertising. So I'm always open to selling ad space on the show. I love being able to do it with independent, you know, business people, people who listen to the show. I love to be able to support each other in that way. If you're interested, you can email me at shoptalknerdy@gmail.com. Also, if you've been keeping an eye on my social media, you may have seen that some friends and I out here in LA have recently launched, or were kind of co-sponsoring, the West Coast Science Communication Retreat, a very small, kind of experimental, unconference style retreat that we're hashtagging SciComm Camp for individuals who work in science communication in a myriad of fields, whether it's, you know, television, radio, writing, podcasting, working with universities, you name it. So we are looking for sponsors for the conference too. And if you're interested, you can go to www.scicomcamp.com. We were really excited to see that we filled up our registration within about 20 minutes on the day that we opened it. Thrilled to see that there was so much interest. And now we just need to make sure that we can make that conference go as well as we possibly can. All right. Enough of that. It's my least favorite part of the show. I know it's yours too. Sorry about it, but thank you for bearing with me. I'm really excited about this week's guest. I had the opportunity to sit down with independent author of Traveling in Space, Stephen Paul Leyva. Here he is. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. As everybody says, they always say, thank you for having me.
I'm having you right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that's... There's a double entendre
exactly.
in
I'm
there
not sure
somewhere.
How appropriate yeah. that is. I am excited to speak with you. I have not seen you in person since the LA Festival of Books.
Probably, yeah.
I think a few years ago.
Yeah.
I met you there. I want to say I was a last-minute substitution for Jen Ouellette, who I've had on the podcast before. She was doing a panel, and I know I wasn't her first pick because my name wasn't printed on the name tag. It was like written in. But we did a panel. I can't even remember. I think about consciousness, maybe, with a bunch of cool different perspectives.
Right.
And you were there, of course, at the Festival of Books because you are a book man. You are an author.
I'm an author, yeah.
And so I'm excited, too, to talk about this this genre of book that I have an interesting relationship with.
The genre science fiction or?
Science fiction.
Yeah, okay.
And I think the reason, you know, I'm also do some of my work on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. I'm their newest member as of about 2 months ago. And they are, you know, stereotypical kind of Star Wars, Star Trek, like ultra sci-fi, ultra fantasy nerds. They know all of the nuance. They know all of the plot lines. They can tell which blaster they're listening to by the sound of it without even seeing it. And I love sci-fi, but I love a very specific type of sci-fi, which is this classical kind of mid-century Bradbury, Orwell, Asimov sci-fi, but I've never been a very good quote-unquote nerd in the traditional sense because I'm not that into pop culture sci-fi.
Yeah, and pop culture sci-fi is, it's funny because it is divided in a sense between Star Trek and Star Wars.
Oh, it's true. You have people who love one and hate the other, and well, then you have people who love them both.
And... Go for the last word in each title. Wars and Trek.
Trek.
That's the difference, and I'm more of a Trek person.
Are you?
Than the Wars, although I was one of the first people to see Star Wars because I was a journalist at the time.
Oh, cool. So you saw an advanced screening?
Went to the one and only press screening, I believe, at the Motion Picture Academy.
So you were living here in L.A. at the time?
Oh, yeah. I'm a native.
You are?
My parents were natives. My dad's parents were natives.
Whoa, it's so interesting to me. I mean, I've mentioned this on the podcast before. I'm always fascinated when I meet people who are LA native because they're very special. They're like a special breed compared to all the people like myself who came here later. But especially when you meet Angelinos who are multiple generation Angelinos.
Well, Leyva's Spanish. And although it could have originally been Jewish. It may have been Levy.
Interesting.
I have a feeling my ancestors in Spain were the ones who, when given the choice to die or get the hell out or convert to Catholicism, said, Hail Mary, you know? So, but there's a town of Leyva in Spain. But I once researched in, I grew up in Azusa, actually, which is a town east of Los Angeles.
Sure, but very close.
Yeah, and east of Pasadena, for about 30 miles away. And, in the Azusa Public Library, I once found a history of California, and in the back was a listing of citizens or residents. I think it was for like from 1750 to 1800. There were 8 Leyvas listed.
Oh, interesting.
And then they were listed as either a soldier or a child. And I don't think there was ever even any females listed. I can't really remember. If they would have been, they would have been obviously a child. But so get a sense that some of them came over as soldiers attached to the mission system. Possibly.
Sure, yeah, that would make sense. Because you're not, when you say it's Spanish, it's Spanish-Spanish.
It's Spanish-Spanish.
It's Hispanic.
It's not Hispanic. It's not Latino. Although, you know, I have no problem with being either, I suppose. But,
sure.
But then my mother was Scotch, Irish, Pennsylvania, Dutch, Welsh, English, French, Canadian, and Kickapoo Indian.
Amazing. So, how do you know that? You put some effort into knowing that.
She told me that.
That's what
she would tell me. And... It was funny because I always figured there was Indian on my dad's side, which there still may be, but there's a Kickapoo Indian, which I think they're down in Texas. I think there's a tribe that has citizenship in both countries because they travel back and forth.
Oh, between Mexico
but
and Texas.
But Kickapoo, I think, originally were on the East Coast and got booted west.
Interesting. Yeah, I think it's always cool when people know, you know, because we're all, at this point, we're all mutts, which is great. The muttier we are, the better we are, I say.
My mom always called it goulash.
Yes, there you go. That's a good way to put it. And it's, you know, I always say I'm Puerto Rican Italian. Oh, I'm Puerto Rican Italian. It's easier, right? My father's Italian. My mother's Puerto Rican. My mother's actually from, her lineage is from the Canary Islands. So they're actually Spanish. They were only in Puerto Rico for a few generations. But my mother's father was who knows what. We only knew her mother. And my father's mother, I don't know what she was either. But I know that because I had an Italian grandfather and a Puerto Rican abuelita, grandmother, that's how I always identified because the rest was like a me?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so for you to be able to list all of the different places.
Well, again, it's what my mother told me.
So your mom did her work. She did her genealogy.
Or she lied. wouldn't have been beyond the
I love
pale.
It. So you come from a long lineage of storytellers. Then.
Yes, yes. yeah, possibly.
And so you're a Trekkie.
Well, the difference being is in popular science fiction, and let me say at the outset, my book, and this is my only pure science fiction mm-hmm. work, and it's not hard science fiction. It is a satire. And it's also a satire on the science fiction genre as well as a satire on humanity. But the Trek people are the ones who are interested in exploration and what the future of mankind in space could actually really be. Even though some of the Trek stories get into wars and what have you, still it's a Trek. Still, yeah. Kirk, even Kirk in some of the early episodes says, I'm a diplomat more than a warrior. Mm-hmm. And of course, then Picard was truly the diplomat. Star Wars is really not a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. It's just he didn't want to put on armor and make a knights movie in England.
Sure.
You know.
So it's taking a classic story of like the triumph of good over evil, a classic story.
Mythological stories.
Yes, the bad guys versus the good guys, and then setting it in a very science fiction setting.
Yep, for the gadgets. Mm-hmm. You know, I think partly.
Well, because gadgets are fun.
Gadgets are fun, and I love that. There's mm-hmm. no problem with that. But there is a strain in science fiction, and I don't read a lot. I read some, but I read all over the map. And I'm a writer, I've written thrillers, mm-hmm. which were satiric. My latest novel, By the Sea, is a pure comic novel with a lot of sex because I find sex very funny.
But there is this common thread, which is satire.
Yeah, satire. And I'm basically a comic writer. My latest novel that I'm just working on to finish now, it's called The Reluctant Heterosexual. You can find the theme there. But in science fiction, there's a lot of the genre. And I'm doing a panel October 3rd at a book festival in Pomona. Mm-hmm. It's the first one called Pomona Reads. And we're putting together a science fiction panel that I'm going to moderate there. And I want to talk to them about why some science fiction is basically looks to the past. Mm. Empires, mm-hmm. you know, and they're fighting the empire or kings or things like that. Although a lot of science fiction, I notice the villains are corporations.
Oh, interesting.
And that probably started back with The Star's My Destination by Alfred Bester. And so they're not hard science. They're basically classic, almost mythic, if not mythological, mythic tales, retold adventures with hard black and white, good and evil divides.
Yes.
Because some of us need to read that. Because good usually triumphs over evil, and you want that.
And it gives you a bit of a sense of order and a sense of kind of justification.
Just like mystery novels, as it's commonly said, a mystery novel is a comfort novel in a way because it throws chaos at you, but they clear it up at the end.
Sure.
Now, that's the classic. Now, modern mystery and modern science fiction do handle a lot of the grays now, and there's all this apocalyptic work, especially in YA, you know, young adult novels about Earth that has been devastated.
Oh, that's true. And you see all these films coming out now that are, piggybacked off those books.
It somewhat bothers me. Is it a reflection of society? Is it a reflection of what people are thinking? Which if it is, then I think they need to reorder their thinking.
Yeah, or is this what kids have grown up hearing so much about climate change and about kind of these directions we're headed that they don't feel like they have much control over, that they feel like they're just along for the ride on?
You wonder if it's that. You also wonder, again, if it's not. Well, I remember there was a fun comic book when I was a kid. It was by DC. Atomic Knights.
Okay.
And it took place after an atomic war. And so society was rebuilding itself. And the good guys put on armor and they were knights. There was something incredibly appealing about starting over, about building a society.
Reorganizing.
We are, especially in Western culture, there's not much to explore, is there?
Hmm. There is in the sciences.
There is in the sciences, which is why I love science.
Yeah.
But I have a play called Made on the Moon, and my character in that, the whole thing is about a young man who all he wants to do is go to the moon. That's his one and only goal. And he talks about being born on the west coast of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
There was nowhere to go exploration-wise but up.
Yeah.
You see? And, of course, that's based on me. I was born here. My family was born here. So, you know, as they say, L.A. is the place you come to redesign yourself, right?
And it used to be the wild, wild west.
And where do I go?
Yeah.
You know, I have nowhere to go. You know, I'm stuck here. I have to be me. So in science, but there, science fiction has the bells and the whistles of graphic wonderfulness, I guess, and awe and wonder and spaceships and God
explosions.
Knows.
Explosions.
I grew up in that. I loved that as a kid. I absolutely adored it. And space became a huge focus for me. I knew I would never be a pilot or anything. I'm blind as a bat, for one thing. But I could dream about it.
Yeah.
So in traveling in space, though, it's basically a 21st century Gulliver's Travels.
And this is the book you were referencing when you said it was your most kind of sci-fi,
yes.
but also satire.
Yes, yes. It's you know what a first contact novel is.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So this is a first contact novel written from the point of view of the aliens.
Which I love.
Okay, so, and I also propose a race of aliens that think they're the only life in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And they call themselves, in fact, life. That's their name. Their planet is called the Living World.
It's very human of them.
Yes, and what they do is explore. They have two loves, which is life and knowledge, and they have two hates, which is ignorance and death.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, all their profanity is based on death and decay. It's not based on sex and excrement.
Mm-hmm.
All their profanity is based on death and hurting people and things like that, but not as profanity. It's something they don't do. They don't like to commit violence, except on a group they have called the 10%ers, because 10% of everyone born is born in ignorant and will never evolve beyond that. And they love their ignorance because they love to hate their ignorance because they love to hate ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
It's
a justifiable hate.
Yeah,
in their minds.
In their minds, mm-hmm. but their contact with Earth changes them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But they believe they're the only life in the universe. They're out exploring because that is their purpose: is to know. Their purpose is basically what I think our purpose should be, which is to survive, to thrive, and to know.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is the main purpose of humanity. So they're out doing that. And suddenly they stumble upon, part of their mission is, if they find a planet that could support their life, they have to colonize it.
Sure.
Because they think part of their mission is to seed the universe with themselves.
Which is kind of what we are attempting to
exactly.
do now.
And they think they're not going to run into these planets too often.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be generation. Well, they suddenly stumble upon a planet that's suitable for life, and holy crap, it actually has life on it. And, oh, wait a minute. That life is sentient. And so they're sort of taken aback. But they have to know, so they have to explore. So they're Gulliver.
And are the humans ignorant?
The humans are us.
But in their view, are we
ignorant? In their view, they're ignorant.
Yeah.
But they come to learn that, wait a minute, there's a segment of them that actually are exploring and looking and seeing. But what really blows them away, because this is a long-lived species, they took millions of years to reach where they are, millions and millions. They're suddenly blown away when they realize that this species has only been around for 200,000 years, that it's actually only been civilized for about 10,000 to 12,000, and that its explosion of exploration, both mentally and physically, has only been about 500 years, and yet they're at this level. This is when they realize that there's something here. But they're still, basically the first part of the book has a lot of comic situations as they run across learning about their culture, politics, sex, religion is a big part of it.
Because the aliens are atheist.
The aliens are atheists. They never created any kind of a mythology of a god, because they took again many, 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 many years to mature. And they loved the question, the thrill of a question, more than the comfort of an easy answer.
Mm.
So the question and questioning and questioning, and they map out, they mapped out the sky through musical notes. It's, you know,
that.
I made up.
But that is something that I think that most of us who self-identify as atheists pride ourselves in, is this idea that sometimes the answers aren't that comfortable. And
that's
sometimes,
right.
You know, we're not inventing a nice fluffy cushion to fall back on, but the you know, striving for knowledge, the discomfort that comes from that is still more valuable.
Well, it's more valuable, and especially in, as I say, surviving and thriving,
mm-hmm.
because it is amazing to think that this species that we are went from Kitty Hawk to Tranquility Base in 66 years.
Yeah.
That's just a symbol of the last 500 years of what we've accomplished.
It's true. It's and, it's a really
right.
rapid evolution.
Rapid flare up like the striking of a match.
Mm-hmm.
The fear is the match going to go out?
Exactly. And that's a theme that I think we do often try to explore in storytelling across the board, whether it's this sci-fi storytelling, fantasy storytelling, as you said, these kind of apocalyptic, especially
yeah.
these young adult novels that have these apocalyptic themes are, you know, where else do we have to go? And is the propensity for violence that comes along with these incredible inventions and this incredible
mm-hmm.
technological advance going to ultimately be the end of us?
Well, that's the question.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer has to be, I think, if we're dumb enough to cause those problems, we're smart enough to solve them. Whether it be climate change, whether it be, you know, we did create the atomic bomb, but except for those two cases,
mm-hmm.
it hasn't been used in war in the 70 some odd years since it was created or whatever. That's a short time, too.
Yeah.
And it's disturbing that, you know, we're being at odds with Russia again, who has a lot of these bombs.
Mm.
But I think our instinct for survival saves us there. But as one of my characters, my lead character who narrates the book, who is in this society, you're often named by an attribute you have or your profession.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the life seeder. He's the one that's looking for a planet that you could actually seed with their life and is the one that discovers the planet, our planet.
Mm-hmm.
As he says towards the end of the book, is if we now know there's more than just us. There's this life here on Earth. There's a life back in our planet. There's the life in our ship, which they call a life ship. And there's the life on this planet. And if all three were wiped out, and if that is the only life in the universe, the thing is, not one tear is going to be shed in the universe,
mm-hmm.
which makes life not sacred, and I hate that word sacred, but makes life precious.
Sure.
And so the thing with the book is what they finally decide. Well, here's the satire on the science fiction tropes with this book. A lot of science fiction first contact, the aliens are either slobbing insect-like creatures that are here for who knows what reason. They're just knocking the crap out of us.
Yeah.
Or they're here to steal our water or to fuck our women.
Yeah, or to understand us by ripping us to shreds and invading us
invading
and probing us.
And but or probing our women.
Exactly.
They
yeah.
never want to fuck our men, by the way, I've noticed. But, or they're more like the Arthur C. Clarke Childhood's End, or even Close Encounters in a way. They're mm-hmm. they're more passive and they're here. And as in the David Brin term, maybe they're here to uplift us.
Sure.
To make us more angel-like. Which to me is a quasi-religious
mm-hmm.
Idea.
And also is like just doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense at all.
What is the motivation for that?
There's no motivation for that. So my aliens, what I propose is if aliens ever come to Earth, it's because they've stumbled upon us like you stumble upon a rock in the middle of a road.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're just going to be curious. And in fact, the name of their ship is the Curious, which I named it long before the Curiosity.
I love it.
and in fact, the publisher of my book, by the way, is this is not his his day job is actually a spaceflight engineer at JPL.
Oh, how fun.
Dave Doody. He flies Cassini around Saturn. Mm-hmm. That's what he does most of the time, as opposed to attending making my book a bestseller. But it's probably nice to have Cassini around Saturn, you know.
Sure. Yeah, that's important too. But you know what I have to say is that I've noticed, because I have a lot of friends, you know, who live mm-hmm. in Pasadena, who work either...
I was born there, by the way.
There you go.
There you go.
Who either work at Caltech or at JPL. And I noticed that so many people who work for NASA, mm-hmm. so many people who, as either scientists or engineers, actually make it their mission to explore, you know, beyond our planet, are incredible sci-fi fans.
Oh, yeah.
Almost all of them.
Well, they
are.
Were probably inspired mm-hmm. by it, which is one of the importance of the literature.
Yeah.
Especially when it is a true what if or a hard science fiction that is really grappling with ideas.
Sure.
All my books, I like to think, are motivated by ideas. Even my, I have two thrillers with a character called The Fixer. Now, I spent 20-some-odd years in Hollywood mm-hmm. producing and writing, and a quasi-science fiction movie you may have heard of called Space Jam.
Oh, yeah.
I produced the animation for that along with a partner and another guy that the studio assigned to us. And in any case...
We won't
deal with that. I think he's left this mortal veil in any case. So my first two thrillers take place in Hollywood. The Fixer is spelled with two X's, by the way, because everybody else calls themselves the Fixer. he fixes the problems of these horrible people in Hollywood. But they're satiric too. They're satiric about Hollywood because I have, you know, spent 20 years being battered by
Hollywood.
And also,
you grew up here.
And I grew up
here.
It's
such a part of the culture, just living here.
Exactly. But there's a core idea in the first one, which is called "Blood Is Pretty," which is sort of science fiction-y because the MacGuffin, to use a Hitchcockian term, is this virtual reality that's better than any virtual reality ever invented called Veritas, mm-hmm. which literally puts you in a world and as if you're there. You don't have, and you do, you actually do put on glasses, but you think you're there.
So
it's like the holodeck.
Or the Velt.
Or the Velt. The Velt, yeah, exactly.
That's it's my reference.
Very much like the Velt. But it, you know, and the guy who created it, who's an egotistic shit, works mm-hmm. at Caltech, and he gets killed, and it's stolen by a film producer who realizes that this it could not only be the greatest entertainment entity beyond movies, but you could control people because mm-hmm. you're in their brain. So that's at the core of it. So the idea also is, what effect do movies and video games have on us? I always worry about that.
Massive.
I always worry. Because you know how when you're dreaming, mm-hmm. and or even when you're in a semi-dream state, and in the dream you trip your leg?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when you're dreaming, your body thinks this is happening because mm-hmm. because the brain has to keep active. And when you're watching a movie or a video game, and this comes into traveling in space as well, because the aliens have something like that as well.
A virtual reality.
A virtual reality thing that they use for entertainment, mm-hmm. and they also use to pacify the ignorance who can be violent.
This is kind of a natural progression.
Right. So what does your brain get from watching the violence or... Do they know they're there?
Well, and that's why virtual reality works so well.
Yeah.
And that's why we're seeing, you know, for example, I've been doing a lot of virtual reality coverage in my day job, which mm-hmm. is mostly television. And I, for example, am somebody who gets very VR sick. So when I put on a headset, if it is not really, really up to speed in terms of frame rates and refresh
right.
rates and things like that, I will not feel well, and I'll need to take it off.
Make you nauseous?
It'll make me really nauseous, because there's a mismatch between mm-hmm. what my ear is experiencing, my inner ear, mm-hmm. and what my brain thinks it should
right.
be experiencing because of what my eyes see. And they're getting better. But one thing that I definitely notice is that if you use, like a lot of virtual reality video games, you'll use a controller and you'll actually be able to fly around with a button instead of by physically walking. And that's where I get really fucked.
Right.
Is when I'm trying, it's, you know, it looks like I'm walking forward, but my brain doesn't feel me walking forward. And I think that that's an important point, because the reason virtual reality works is because you experience the outer world the same as you would a non-virtual world.
Right.
Your body physically reacts to it. You find yourself just like in the old 50s pictures of people watching 3D movies where they're grabbing in the air at the butterflies flying at them, and you find yourself stepping backward. I did a fun demo for one show where you're supposed to walk a plank and the floor drops out beneath you. It looks like it's, you know, 50 feet down. And then you're supposed to, at the very end of it, turn to the side perpendicular to the plank and just step off and take a leap of faith. And you know that you're not stepping off of anything. But the researcher who made this paradigm, I did it after much, you know, trepidation, and he told me that something like only 30% of people are willing to actually take that leap.
Because the brain is telling them something.
Exactly. So you think you're really there.
The brain is terribly malleable. Mm-hmm. It can be influenced. And so in Blood is Pretty, the guy says, I can influence politics.
Sure.
I can become... He doesn't quite know what he's going to do with it, but he knows. And the fixer, of course, is the hero, and he's bound to stop him.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always ideas somewhere in the center of what I'm writing.
And there must be. I mean, I think for any story to resonate, for any story to be larger than, you know, a dime store pass the time kind of flit.
Yeah.
It must be utilizing these themes and these ideas that are significant to us as people, you know, and whether it's a great love story, whether it's a story about triumph over evil, or whether it's something more nuanced and more, I think, creative than that, which is ideology. It's something that matters, you know, because ideas ultimately are, in my view, what have a lasting effect on the world. There's action, of course, but action almost always follows ideas.
Right, motivated by the ideas.
Always. And and even when we think of extreme examples of that, when we think of unrest in the Middle East, when we think of extremist Islamic terror groups, when we think of human slavery, when we think of horrible things that are happening across the world, almost always it's an ideology that we haven't been able to penetrate, a mind that we haven't been able to change, that really feeds all of the insane activity following it.
Well, people are looking for justification for their actions.
Sure.
And I just wrote a review that I'll be turning in. I write book reviews for the New York Journal of Books, which is a online book review magazine.
Sure.
That's there to help replace all those book reviews in daily newspapers that have been cut.
Died.
So all the reviewers are qualified, and they do it where the review comes out on the publication date of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an amateur, you know, book club type book review.
Yeah, you get the advance copy.
Yeah.
You're not allowed
exactly
to leak anything. And
So this is a book by a Nigerian-American authoress, if I can put a sex designation
authoress
to words. Authoress. It's like actress. You can't call a woman an actor,
actually,
an actress
now,
anymore.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah.
Oh, can you go back to it?
No, I think everybody wants to be called actor. Yeah.
That exactly. Yeah. They all want to be an actor.
Which I guess, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
It makes sense and it doesn't.
It's whatever makes you happy.
So true. I mean, and some women don't want to be designated. I think historically women wanted to be called actresses because they didn't like having a male title.
Yeah.
But I think now having this distinction, because we do see in Hollywood, this is a total aside, but we do see it's always best actor first, then best actress. And of course we know that female roles are completely outnumbered by male roles. And it's very rare to see female leads in films or even in books.
But being called actor hasn't helped them.
No, of course not. I think it's a personal feeling of empowerment.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, don't insult me.
The people who runs it are still basically male. you know.
Oh my God, so true. Know.
And they want
huge
they,
problem.
Yeah, they want the action films.
Yeah, yeah.
But look at all the women in action films now.
It's getting better, but it's still nowhere close. When you look at the actual measurements, it's nowhere close.
I have an essay in mind to write, which would be called "Women Who Kick Ass, Girls Who Kick Balls," and what it goes off is the fact I was once standing. My daughter had these friends when she was young. We had to go to a pool party, which is something I'm not particularly fond of. And all these guys, all of which who are taller than me, I'm not a tall person, and I always find it nervous to stand by tall men. It's like going in an elevator in a main business building in downtown with all these tall executives. It's like standing in the middle of the Redwoods. In any case, but they're standing there, and they're all in. They all have daughters, and they're all into their daughters' soccer game, and they're coaching them, and they're really into it. And I hate sports of any kind, and I'm just standing there feeling like Woody Allen. And they keep talking about this girl and that girl, and finally, I just said, personally, I don't think we should be having girls' soccer. They look at me why? And
no.
I said, why are we men teaching girls how to competently kick balls? And they're still not quite getting that I'm joshing with them. No one really laughed. That's tall people don't get my humor. But this review of this book, it's a story of a lesbian in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. Young girl grows up and realizes she's a lesbian. And has a couple of love affairs with other women, obviously. It starts in the Civil War between 67 and 70 when Biafra tried to break away as the secessionist state and goes on from there. And, of course, when she's found out and her mother finds out, her mother puts her through intensive Bible study to tell her what an abomination this is. But I start writing the review by talking about, again, how quickly we have learned as a species. But hopefully, along with that, is not just learning physical things in which we can create tools, whether it be a glass is but a tool, and all tools are an extension of a human ability. So a glass is an extension of being able to cup your hands.
Yes.
And a computer is an extension of your own memory and note-taking and calculations, and you can do it mentally or whatever. That's all fine. And we live in, especially in the Western culture, we live in a very comfortable thing with AC and what have you. But hopefully what goes along with that is a certain maturation. And are we maturing as a species? Are we becoming more compassionate, tolerant, and accepting of other people that are not part of our tribe, no matter what the tribe is? Well, here's a woman living in Africa with a lot of tribal division, and of course, this huge tribal division between heterosexuals, religious heterosexuals too, and a homosexual. And if we go by what I think is a wonderful book, The Better Angels of Our Nature by Steven Pinker, he pretty much demonstrates that we have matured. Got a long way to go, but we have. There's statistics to show that it's a less violent world than it was. But the point is, the species does not mature all on one level.
Yeah,
so
there are leaders that bring us forward.
Geographically, there are areas less mature than the Western nations, let's call it. Or within the Western nations, there are people who are less mature.
And even geographic regions within Western culture.
That's what I'm saying, that. So, you know, in Nigeria in 2014, they have a new law criminalizing same-sex relationships. Mm-hmm. If you're in South Nigeria, you could get up to 14 years.
And
if
one
you're
thing,
in North Nigeria, which is Islamic, you can be stoned to death.
Sure, yeah. And
but
one
here
thing
we
that
have
we should
county
remember,
clerks.
Yes, we do. We have county clerks, and it shows, you know, everybody's obsessed with Kim Davis, and I say it's a nothing story because it just shows how marginalized that side of the argument right. has become in the U.S. But one thing that we have to remember, and if you've never seen the amazing documentary God Loves Uganda, I definitely recommend it, in Uganda specifically, but I think that this holds true in other regions of Africa. This new resurgence of hatred towards homosexuality
oh, yeah.
is definitely seeded and fueled by Westerners.
Oh, really?
Yes, that there is a lot of missionary activity,
yeah, yeah, that's
that
what
there's a lot of spread of Western religious ideology in these regions. So unfortunately, even though it's pretty easy to say that we enjoy the fruits of our kind of constitutional labors here mm-hmm. in the United States, that doesn't mean that ideological differences that maybe aren't, you know, I guess legally upheld in our culture aren't still bleeding into cultures that don't have the same legal protection.
Well, because it's like the tobacco companies going down to Africa and South America because they can't sell as many cigarettes here.
Exactly, because the laws haven't caught up to protect
still selling
the citizenry. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the people themselves, you know.
Well, of course,
example,
the missionaries went to Africa for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is, and Nigeria is the second most religious country in the world, mm-hmm. I believe. And when she puts her through Bible study, she tells the story of Lot. And two angels come down to Lot. And he welcomes them in, and they're going to spend some time, I guess, have a vacation with them. And a lot of the neighborhood guys come by and say, send the angels out. We want to have our way with them.
Mm-hmm.
That this is in Sodom, and, you know, they're Sodomites.
Yep.
That's what they want to do.
That's what they do.
And he won't do that, but he says, but I have two virgin daughters here who you're welcome to have. Now, in the ancient world, hospitality was one of the greatest virtues. This is true in Homer. You can read this in the Odyssey. You can read this in Herodotus.
Mm-hmm.
Hospitality, it was huge. Traveler comes to you, you must pay them a certain respect and give them hospitality.
And also women were apparently objects.
Women were objects. But the mother says this proves that God thinks homosexuality is abomination because he would rather give his virgin daughters to these guys than to let them have homosexual love with the angels, which would be an abomination. And the daughter is trying to say, well, isn't this talking about the virtue of hospitality?
Mm.
Which actually, this particular section, it seems a little bit more polemic and academic than what a 14-year-old girl might
probably
be
sure,
saying.
But sure.
But maybe
she was very precocious.
Yes, maybe she was very precocious. But the point is, one way I've always seen religion, and one of the faults of religion, is it's utilized to give authority to natural prejudices.
Sure.
So it's not that God tells you homosexuality is wrong, it's that you think homosexuality is wrong, so you find yourself a sacred text to back up your own first impression of this particular thing.
Why do you think that it's wrong? Oftentimes, it's because it's frightening. It's a dark water that you may have dipped your toe into, and that made you very nervous, and you backed away from it. I think it's very common that people hate what they fear,
of course.
People fear what they worry that they themselves may possess.
Well, I don't think everybody is necessarily a closet gay.
No, I don't either,
but also,
I definitely think that homosexuality, as most academic studies have shown, falls on a continuum, and that it's not a black and white issue.
No, it's not, because in the final analysis, what it is it's like, I believe one of the greatest things in the world is a hug.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a hugger. I love hugging people. Thank God I don't work for a corporation. I'd be up on harassment charges like crazy. That's why you have pets too, dogs and cats.
Yeah, it's for an emotional.
We are mammals.
Yeah,
we are warm-blooded mammals,
and
there's great
animals.
Comfort. Yeah, there's great comfort in touching other warm mammals, and this can extend from affection, into love, into sex.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the sex is still driven by hormones telling you to procreate.
And trust me, those hormones will be there whether you have a member of the opposite sex present or not.
Right. Well,
this is why prison sex is something that happens to, quote, heterosexual people.
Basically you're talking about organs that are sensitive to stimulation, and it makes you feel good.
Exactly. And it doesn't matter. Many things in that equation don't matter.
Yeah. It's but beyond that, if you can find love with anybody of any sex,
mm-hmm.
or affection, I don't even know if love is a thing that actually exists.
Ooh, interesting.
It is a term we apply to companionship, to affection,
to a je ne sais quoi,
to someone who you would miss greatly, mm-hmm. if they were out of your life. It's like evil. I don't think evil exists.
Mm-hmm.
I think the concept, in fact, this is in Traveling in Space again too, because they're one of my favorite characters is, well, I was telling you before that there's a lot of comic and comedy from the aliens trying to understand humans,
mm-hmm.
And also finding out that there are certain things they like about humans, like cheese danishes and things like
they
that.
They like the cheese danishes?
Yeah, they love cheese danishes. But then they get to a point where suddenly they see a mass killing,
mm-hmm.
genocide. Now, again, these people can't stand the idea of death and
why
killing.
Would anybody choose?
Yeah. No. So one of the explorers actually sees, we assume it's probably a Balkan war, a mass execution, mm-hmm. of people, and reports on it. And then the two main characters have to come and calm him down in a sense. But then they run into a woman who works for like a world court on genocide. And she's a 93-year-old woman who's been at this since World War II,
mm-hmm.
A lesbian. And she's a kick in the head. Margaret Cleveland is her name, and I wrote her to be that kind of a person.
Mm-hmm.
But even though she's been at this and seen this sort of thing for 50-some-odd years, she explains to the aliens that the only real evil in the world is believing that there is evil in the world.
Hmm.
Because it's not that, as she says, Hitler was evil. The problem was he thought the Jews were.
Sure.
And when you think something is evil, and evil is something by definition needs to be eradicated, then you have authority to eradicate it.
It's this idea that it's an intrinsic principle that exists kind of outside of our subjective perspective.
Right.
That, I think when we first came up with words,
mm-hmm.
we want to go back to the etymology of the word in mm-hmm. general. We use this term symbolic interactionism. You know, this is a common term that linguists use, that we're trying to interact with each other, and we would draw pictures, we would do things, flail our arms around, we would try to make vocalizations. But really, I can look at a table.
Right.
A table is a real thing, and I can ascribe a label to the table, and that label is the word table. And now all of a sudden, I have a shortcut to communicating with you. And so there are physical things that we can describe, and then there are conceptual things mm-hmm. that we can describe, and the conceptual things are nuanced, and the conceptual things are relative.
Exactly.
And I think that the mistake falls when you try to make a concept into something that is physical.
Right. And trying to portray evil as a force, mm-hmm. and of course in certain religions it is Satan, it is an actual physical entity that contends with a lord or a god.
Yeah. And in Star Wars, it's a force.
Well, the force is the good
the
thing.
The force
although
is the good
it's,
thing.
It's used poorly by Darth Vader.
The force, the force is the good thing. That's true. But evil is something that must be overcome by the force.
Right.
In and of itself.
And often we call something evil that is contending with something we want.
Oh, true. Yeah, that's why it's so subjective.
Yeah, it is subjective. Now, that doesn't mean there's not evil acts
mm-hmm.
and evil things happen.
But also, I think it's one of those things that, sure, there are things in the world, probably very, very few things, but things nonetheless, that regardless of your perspective, there is a general consensus that they are morally bankrupt, that they are what we would say is equal. I think there are a lot more things in the world that if we had the powers of empathy that we don't always possess,
right,
that we would start to understand why it's a more complicated question than just good and evil.
Which could bring us back to novels.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's been some, you may have read of some of the current studies that they do with people. They give them a novel to read, and then they give them an empathy test. And after reading a novel, their empathy level goes up.
And do you think that's because you're forced for a sustained period of time to experience that first person perspective?
To experience another person's mm-hmm. point of view, to walk in another man's shoes. I couldn't walk in high heels, so I say another man's shoes.
Yeah. Fine, I'll give you a pass on that one.
And in some of them, they say it's literary novels. This will go back to science fiction, that this happens. But there's no effect when you read a genre novel.
Oh, interesting.
A mystery or science fiction. But then those genres don't always deal with getting into the interior life mm-hmm. of a person.
And of course, there are crossovers. There are genre yeah. novels that are themselves that, literary novels.
Well, you take P.D. James mm-hmm. in mystery and the current mysteries. If you have a cozy mystery like Agatha Christie, it's all going to be about plot, and mm-hmm. it's a joy. It can be a joy. The more modern mysteries will often be, if they're not serial killer stories, which seems to be every one of them, it more is a psychological, a Ruth Rendell
yeah.
type or something. In science fiction, you're dealing often in types, whether they be archetypes or stereotypes, mm-hmm. as far as characters. If it's a good, hard science fiction novel with a lot of ideas, the ideas are what are important. So it's a little colder in that sense when it comes to empathy.
Gotcha.
And in mystery. So, but in a literary novel, which is also my great love, and I'm hoping that the By the Sea, which is my newest one out, being although a comic novel, I'd like to think it's a literary novel,
mm-hmm.
and the new one, Reluctant Heterosexual. But that just shows you how malleable the form of the novel is, of storytelling. We are born storytellers, obviously. It's one of the most important functions in our society is to hear stories. Now, most people get their stories from visual media, from movies, from television, even from gaming,
mm-hmm.
Which is interesting. I've never been able to get into gaming, but obviously I grew up with movies. I grew up with television. I was born in May of 1949, and my parents, I think, bought themselves a TV set that Christmas. So this is 1949, because my dad always said he wanted to hear the pitter-patter of little feet in the house, but what he meant was Hopalong Cassidy's horse, as opposed to me. But
Just drown you out there.
Turn up that TV. And it's funny, because I don't remember my parents ever having a radio.
Mm-hmm. But you're right. Even before the television yeah. started to take over, you know, we see this imagery of people surrounding the radio and listening to these serial radio
right.
programs.
Oh, my mother was a big fan of those. I remember mm-hmm. talking about One Man's Family and, the one about a kid. Henry Aldridge.
Sure.
Henry! The mother would start with.
Sure.
And then, but once my mom got a television, she never listened to radio.
But the cool thing is that's coming back. And you see it with the breakout success of, podcasting kind of has its ebbs and flows.
Right.
And of course, this style of podcasting that we're doing right now is not story driven.
Right.
It's more conversationally driven.
Right.
But there are, Serial, for example, Radiolab,
yes.
for example, that are huge successes. This American Life, that are story driven.
Right. Right. Exactly. Some of them are nonfiction stories, mm-hmm. but still, it's what
they still have a strong
in nonfiction.
Character.
It's what they now call like creative nonfiction.
Exactly.
Which is interesting.
I love that genre.
Now, traveling in space, there's an audiobook,
mm-hmm.
and I produced it and directed it. Dave Duty, the publisher, he saw me out at the West Hollywood Book Festival, and I was interviewed on camera by this outfit called Gorilla Reads, where they go to the places like this, they contact an author, and we want you to read from your work while you're there. So mm-hmm. that's on YouTube. You can find that, Gorilla Reads, and I read a section from Traveling in Space. And Dave had not ever seen me actually read from the book. Mm-hmm. And this was just before the book was published. And he said, we got to do an audiobook. You can narrate your own book. And I said, I don't want to do that. And he says, why? You do a great reading. I said, yeah, I know. But Dave, I'm a ham. I'm not an actor. Mm-hmm. I'm a good ham. I took drama in high school and it changed my life. Absolutely changed my life.
It probably made you a better writer.
Well, I came out of it, though, not so enamored with the players as I was with the plays. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to become a writer. By the time I left high school, I knew I wanted to be a writer. But I had, previous to this, directed. In 2010, I created a week-long series of events called Ray Bradbury Week. Mm-hmm. Ray was an old friend of mine. I knew Ray for 30 years.
One of my favorites.
And it was his 90th birthday, and I was determined that it couldn't pass without notice. So I got the city council involved, Eric Garcetti, who's now our mayor. I got Hugh Hefner involved in the Playboy Foundation, and we did a series of events during that week, and it was called Ray Bradbury Week. And what was the point of all this? as part of it, I directed a one act of Ray's called The Better Part of Wisdom, mm-hmm. which is not a science fiction piece. It's a piece that takes place in England among this Irish grandfather travels to see his grandson living in London. And I peg it in late 50s, early 60s, and discovers that his grandson is living with a man and is gay, mm-hmm. and his reaction to it. And it was Ray's attempt to say, it's love that matters, not the details. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's a beautiful little piece. It started as a short story and the one-act play. I had James Cromwell playing the grandfather. He's a great actor. Seamus Dever, if you watch Castle, I don't know mm-hmm. if you do, he's the Irish cop, the young Irish cop. He's played the grandson. And then an actor that was recommended to me I had not met named Jeff Cannata. Now, Jeff's big on the internet. He used to be co-host of the Totally Rad Show. Mm-hmm. He does We Have Concerns right now with Anthony Carboni, and these are podcasts that are very popular. And he's does a lot of podcasts on science fiction and gaming. He's mm-hmm. really into gaming.
Very popular topics.
But I found out he's a well-trained and superb actor. In fact, he and Seamus Dever had did the Texas Shakespeare Festival together or something. Anyway, so I said, Dave, I know the guy to do it. And we did it ourselves, knowing we could put it up on Audible and, mm-hmm. and through Amazon and all that. We didn't have to go through them to have it done. And my best friend's a film editor, and he's basically set up a recording studio in his editorial bay. And so we did it. It took us 2 years.
Wow.
Well, Jeff is very busy. His schedule is crazy. Peter, goes on and off jobs. Mm-hmm. And also, he had a medical emergency to do with a little thing called cancer. Mm-hmm. He's perfectly fine now. I had a not such a serious medical emergency where they decided that I didn't need my gallbladder anymore.
Well, my mom things, had that. It was fun.
Yeah, but we eventually got it done, and it's there. And Jeff, I told Jeff, I don't want a reading. I want a performance. Mm-hmm. You're the only actor I have. He does 35 separate voices. There's a lot of characters in my novel. 35 separate voices, and it's done like almost like it's a straight reading of the play, but it's in first person.
Mm-hmm.
So it's done dramatically.
Yeah.
And we're very proud of it. And because Jeff has a good following, it's sold fairly well.
I can't believe I don't even know if I could come up with 10 different voices.
He's incredible, and he's such a good actor. And as much as he loves this internet stuff and his fame is there, it saddens me a little bit because this guy should be doing world-class plays. And
so I have to ask you, do you think that listening to an audiobook is the same or brings you the same benefits as physically reading the book yourself?
They've done studies on that too, and I can't remember the outcome. It kind of depends. I find most people who listen to audiobooks are either driving.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They're busy.
It's hard. They're doing something physically.
They're at the gym.
It's hard to sit down at a chair and listen because you'll nod off mm-hmm. often. When I listen to them, it's during my walk. I listen to a lot of podcasts during my walk, including yours, of course. When I write often, especially on a novel, I take a 30, 40-minute aerobic walk mm-hmm. almost every morning. I'll dictate into a microcassette. That's how I do my first draft.
Okay? That's smart.
And then I come home. When I don't have some writing to do, I'll be listening to a podcast. There's brilliant ones you can get from the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible about culture, philosophy, history, what have you. But when I listen to an audiobook, the best way is when you're walking too. So I love the human voice. And literature started as an oral tradition, obviously. Homer, he may have been blind, but he had a good voice, I guess. and I just read a wonderful Mary Renault novel, or Renault, called The Praise Singer, which is about historic character who was a great poet in pre-democratic Athens, just as the turnover, as democracy was happening there. But, and, you know, he was a celebrity, go from town to town.
Oh, sure.
And what have you. But it also talked about the time where some of us are saying, you know, we've got to start, we've got writing now. We've got to start putting this down because people's memories aren't always going to hold this. And there's differences and it changes. So it was an oral tradition. When I write, I try to write for the human voice. That's why I like to dictate. One, I find, I think the dialogue comes off as more natural.
And I think that's how most people read.
And
they say the words in a voice inside their heads. That's how I read.
Well, there's people who don't, my mother didn't.
Interesting.
And that whole Evelyn Wood speed reading.
Yeah, I don't like that.
See, my mother learned how to do that on her own. And she used to say to me, I don't hear the words, I see images.
Interesting. But I wonder if the comprehension is the same.
Well, they say in Evelyn Wood it is, but the more frightening thing, I had a cousin once who told me that when he reads a novel, he only reads the dialogue. He skips all the description.
Oh, no.
And as a writer, that just made me want to throw up.
So wait, I've got to ask you, how many books, like, do you actually read? And are you a fast reader?
No. It's the bane of my existence.
I'm such a slow reader, I always have a stack that I want to get to.
I've been a slow reader my whole life. Now, when I took on this, I started, well, you've got me involved in writing for Huffington Post.
Oh,
I started my own blog, as you know, you got me. And I, besides writing essays, like I did the Science is Not a Frog essay on
there.
Which later Massimo Pigliucci put on his Scientia Salon.
Wonderful.
How does I pronounce it Scientia, but that's not right.
Oh, I know. I always had that problem with pharyngula or pharyngula.
Or something.
Yeah, it's like, there's so many.
But in the book reviewing, I've been reading more lately because I obligated. The thing is, once you get on this New York Journal of Books, you
have to read them.
Well, you get access to the catalogs. It's like being in a candy store. And I, in this period, I overbooked myself and I just wrote the guy and said, I've got to pull back a little bit because I got to work on my own stuff.
What happens if you get a book that sucks? Do you have to finish it and write about it? Or do you ever go like,
this is not a well-paying gig. In fact, it pays nothing. So I can probably do whatever I want.
Has that happened
but
to you? Though,
I personally feel obligated.
You do.
I just told my wife this morning, you know, my wife, Amanda Martin, KCET, I don't enjoy writing a book that I feel I have to criticize because I see something. And this book by that I just read, The Nigerian, as important a book as it is by subject matter, I found some fault with it, and I have to point that out. But my review for that, before that, was of an incredible graphic novel called Democracy, which is a historical novel in comic book form, for lack of a better word, about the beginnings of democracy in ancient Athens. And it's brilliantly done. And the guy who does it, in fact, is also, he's Greek, I believe. His name is certainly Greek, and I assume maybe he's in Greece. But he's been an animator and a storyboard artist and what have you. And you can see there's cinematic value to what he's done. He really knew how to lay out the pages, and even his drawings are what in animation, I was involved in animation for 20 years, would be called poses. And a pose in animation, which you pose out the character to act it, so a pose is but a frozen moment of movement, but you put it all together and you have performance, you have acting. And that was a delight to to write because I really want people to know how good this book is. So I, if something is unreadable, I think I would stop.
Sure, sure. I mean, if it's unreadable, I would hope that it didn't get published in the first place.
Well, that's not true.
What a bummer.
It's and what pains me, and I'm what is called an independent author. Mm-hmm. I've not been published by a major publisher, like I say, I have Blue Roof Press. But also my other novels are out through Crossroad Press, which is a very interesting press. But both utilize the modern technology, digital publishing technology of ebooks, mm-hmm. and digital printing, which becomes printed, but it's stored digitally and be chunked out by these big machines. So it's not the big New York corporate publishing gig, and it really bothers you. I read a book, which I've reviewed. It's called... Girl Waits with Gun. It's a historical novel written by a normally nonfiction author who's been well regarded, and it's a fascinating story because it's about one of the first female sheriffs in our country, mm-hmm. who in I think it's like 1912 or something like that in New Jersey gets into an accident. She's in her buggy. She lives on a farm with her two sisters, one of whom is actually her daughter, but no one knows that, but her and her sister, her other sister, and a motor car driven by a rich man. Mm-hmm. And the rich man won't accept responsibility and later starts to harass, and he's part of the Black Hand gang, and he starts to harass this woman. And so they have to deal with that, and eventually it leads to her being asked to join the local sheriff's department. Mm. So it's certainly, it's a historical personage that is good for us to know about.
Sounds interesting,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, sounds very interesting. But I found the book didn't service the history well. It's supposed to be the beginnings of a mystery series, and yet there's not too much mystery in it because... it's fictionalized, and she made things up, and she talks about the areas I made up. But the actual story of the woman, I think she stuck to too religiously, if I may put it that way, mm-hmm. Which does lead to a lot of suspense or mystery. And I couldn't help but think that this is big-time New York publishing. This is being manufactured more... than it coming out of some joy. I think the author has joy in what she's doing.
Yeah, but the author's not necessarily going to be able to get published.
Right. Who knows how it's been changed by the publisher.
And you see it. You see it in books. You see it. I mean, this is a stupid example, but my boyfriend and I, we've been watching the television show Friday Night Lights on Netflix, and it's actually quite good.
Well, it's supposed to be. Well, you come from Texas.
Texas. So not only is the show very well done, it's beautifully mm-hmm. acted, it's well produced. They've won a lot of Emmys back when it was on air. Yeah. And of course, it gives me a little twitchy kind of PTSD watching it because that was my life. But we definitely found season one brilliant. Season two, jump in the shark a little. Late season two, really pushing, coming back around to season three once they got it. I think it was either season three or season four that they actually left network television and went to pure like Netflix production or something like that. Massive changes. You can actually see in the storytelling the influence of the network. You know what I mean? You can see the influence of the editors. You can see when the creators and the people for whom this was a passion project start to lose their grasp a little and then regain it.
Well, that's when you have a big collaborative mm-hmm. work of art. This is one reason why, again, I was in film for over 20 years. And I was there by mistake. I used to joke to people that film was my day job mm-hmm. because I wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. But through a series of circumstances, I wound up falling in love with the art of animation. Stupid thing to do because I can't draw except blood on occasion. And so I had to be a promoter. I had to be a producer and what have you. And early on, I got involved with Brad Bird before anybody knew who Brad Bird was and helped try to... get a film adaptation of a great comic book called The Spirit, which later Frank Miller did in live action horribly. But this was going to be animation. Now, this is 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, it was Disney is dying, and the only other animated features were Care Bears.
Hilarious.
The Spirit was superhero film noir.
Mm-hmm.
And they had made a test film, which I finally put up on YouTube. I found an old VHS I had of it, and it's gotten like 40,000 hits or something, that Brad Bird and several people who went on to become very famous animators, I think John Musker worked on it and what have you, did. It was like a film trailer for the movie.
Cool.
But all done in pencil test. But so I wound up evangelical, and I've got an evangelical nature, which is a bitch for an atheist, you know, because I don't want to be evangelical about atheism. Yeah. I don't believe it's something you be evangelical.
So you got
to
pick something else like
art.
Like
was,
art.
Art was my big passion, and I saw a revolution coming, and I wanted to be part of the revolution. But eventually I realized that I don't like collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my ex-partner, Jerry Reese, used to say, I'll collaborate as long as I have the final say.
It is a tough thing, especially when it comes to art that can be so personal.
Yeah.
I mean, I think collaboration is absolutely necessary to so many endeavors. And
I
think that you're not a well-rounded person unless you know how to work well with others, you know, play well with others. But there are definitely aspects of creativity and art that I think necessitate a little bit of weird loneliness.
Of course, absolutely. I'm only well-rounded around my stomach. That's why when I finally, 20 years ago, and I was always writing during this period, but when I had a chance, but I just started concentrating on writing the novels.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I define art very simply. It's the self-expression of a Homo sapien.
Mm-hmm.
That's what art, whether it's painting. A guy in a bar who can fart out the national anthem,
mm-hmm.
in a sense, that's art.
He's worked at it.
He's worked at it. That's his self-expression. Now, not all art is created equal, you know. And there's fine art, and there's art that deeply is moving, and there's art that's almost on the level of craft or quiche, but can have its pleasures. But it's we need to express ourselves.
Mm-hmm. It's a fundamental
and,
kind of human.
Yeah, and
process.
Collaboration can be fun, but if you're not built that way, I see the writing of novels like the painting of a painting. There's very few paintings that there was collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there may have been students of Da Vinci's that helped paint certain things, but it was all his vision.
Or patrons, you know, that asked for something to be painted for them. But
exactly.
Definitely they didn't pick up a brush.
They didn't pick up the brush.
Add a little squiggle
right.
here and there.
Music composition. You can sometimes have collaboration, but usually it's music and lyrics.
Yeah, that's true.
But two composers trying to compose the actual music. Beethoven didn't have collaborators. Mozart didn't collaborators.
And
so.
that would be and probably has been a very new thing, you know, a collaborative...
Right.
Symphony would be a very kind of offbeat,
modern
thing.
I can't
to
think
do.
Of any collaborative composers.
No, especially not on a regular basis.
Yeah,
that's true.
It's very personal.
It's personal.
And that's where the quirks come in, too. You, the thing is, in Hollywood or in a big collaboration, people keep trying to make it perfect. And people all have to have their say.
When they try to make it appeal to the broadest audience possible, and in doing so, it loses its nuance, it loses its quirk, it loses its depth.
Yeah.
You know, this is why I was so nervous when, for example, Stephen Colbert left his post to then do late night television, because it's a different audience and it's a different game. And it's a different utilization of a skill. I prefer oftentimes things... Sometimes I like things that are very mainstream.
Right.
And sometimes I like things that are very, very niche as we say in Texas, niche.
Colbert has, I like niche. Colbert has pretty much brought himself to CBS. My wife's a big, we DVR it, so it's what we watch as we eat dinner when she comes home from work, which usually I prepare. I'm a nice house husband.
You very much are. I mean, there's no denying that he's a very, very smart person and a very funny person, and he can't shake that. I miss his character.
Oh, yeah, because he played the pundit and the conservative pundit.
And that is satire.
But he's doing a lot of politics.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. So, I just think there's so much more you can say sometimes under the veil of satire.
Well, I think so. And that takes us right back to traveling in space.
Exactly. And so on that note, I have to tell you, we're running so low on time.
Okay.
And I always end my podcast the same way. But before we go into that ending piece, I do want to at least make a mention of a message that you sent me a little while ago, because you had listened to an episode of Talk Nerdy in which I was speaking with, I can't even remember which episode it was, but you mentioned this idea.
Donald Johansson.
Yes. Yeah. Don Johansson, so the discoverer of Lucy, of Australopithecus afarensis.
Which was an important book in my upbringing, Lucy.
Oh my gosh. And what an incredibly just warm and brilliant and creative thinker. It was such a joy to be able to interview him. And we talked about this concept that the best way to tell a scientific story is through story.
Exactly.
You know, and I think that's so important, because I think it speaks to partially why I wanted to have you on the show. I mean, technically, my show is a science show. We don't always do science. Sometimes we like to talk about things that are allied with science, especially science fiction, especially for me, politics, atheism, all of those things I think are deeply intertwined. But we don't often give a nod to how important storytelling is, how important nonfiction, but also fiction is to the
fiction
craft.
Especially, because it, just as you were saying, all those friends of yours at JPL and Caltech are all science fiction. They were inspired. They were inspired by Star Trek. They're inspired. I don't know if Star Wars.
Been inspired by it, but they are huge Star Wars nerds.
Yeah, some scientists have been was inspired by Lost in Space, for Christ's sake.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's like you never know.
You never know.
I mean, for me, Jurassic Park was huge. It was really inspirational. Contact was really inspirational.
I hated the book.
Did you?
And Carl Sagan is a god for me.
And you didn't said like the atheist. Book. Yeah,
he wasn't a good fiction writer. The movie is interesting.
He was definitely a very strong nonfiction, and more like he's a very strong philosophy writer.
Exactly.
And I think that's not what everybody got from his writings, but definitely he's a deep philosophical thinker.
You know, the whole "we are all stardust" that concept. I tell you, though, what really turned me around, and I was a kid who got F's and D's on all my science courses and flunked math, but there was a show, if you've never seen it, you must see it, The Ascent of Man by Jacob Bronowski, who was a great scientist, ended his career at down in Torrey Pines at the Salk Institute, was a refugee from World War II, I think. But it was a BBC show. You can still get the DVDs. You can probably find episodes on YouTube. As documentaries are a little slow to the modern viewing, maybe. But he's the one that made me what I call a Homo sapiens chauvinist. And I do a presentation sometimes after reading from my book called Confessions of a Homo Sapiens Chauvinist. And that's where I propose this idea that, you know, if we want something bigger than ourselves to believe in, it's our species. Mm-hmm. And if we want a purpose in life, it is, as I said, to survive, to strive, and to know. And it was men like Jacob Bronowski and Carl Sagan and Richard Dawkins that taught me that.
I love it. Beautiful. All right. Yeah. Well, so we're getting close to the end, and I want to ask you a question that I think probably feeds into those comments that you just made. I ask every guest on my podcast the same two questions at the end, and you are no exception.
Thank you.
So to start, I want to know, when you think about the future, what is the thing that most concerns you? What is the thing that keeps you up most at night? But on the flip side of that, and sometimes these are related, sometimes they're two totally different thoughts, what are you optimistic about and really look forward to?
Well, what usually keeps me up late at night is an enlarged prostate. But no, I tell you what keep me up at night. What I worry about most is the future of humanity. What I worry about most is that we are not going to be that continuous light, but that match that is struck, that flares, and that burns out. that to me would be, as I said, there's not one tear in the universe would be shed, but I think it would be the saddest thing in the world. And that's why I say I'm a homo sapiens chauvinist. I also worry about, though, as we look for a future, people proposing this whole transhumanist idea of uploading consciousness and maybe becoming non-corporeal. And I'm not sure, I'm not sure it's doable. Now, have you ever read Antonio Damasio?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I understand some of what he's talking about, is that the brain, part of its function is to map and regulate the body,
sure,
the physical body.
Yeah, a huge, huge portion of the brain is dedicated to keeping us going.
Right, and the mind is part of that, and our thinking is part of that as well. And I worry about all the people that really seem to want to go non-corporeal and uplift us to some floating consciousness aren't getting it, but also that they're just like Descartes, that they still see a split between the mind and the body.
Yeah, they want to bring back this dualist idea.
I don't think there is that dualism. And I like bodies, not mine particularly, but in general. I like that warm human flesh. Again, that kind of the hug. I can't hug. So I worry about us heading there, and yet I want a future. The positive thing is, like I say, if we're so dumb that we can cause these problems, we're also so smart that we can solve them. And I think we will become a multi-planet species. I don't know if we'll ever get out of our solar system, but I think we will continue to explore. And I think we have to. Otherwise, it's the death of the species. And there's no reason why our species shouldn't die. But it's my species, so I don't particularly want it to die.
And I think that you are not alone in that thinking.
I hope so.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for
joining me.
This is a great chat.
It's been great.
Lots of fun. And everybody, thank you so much for coming back week after week. I'm just so happy to have you. I'm so happy for the support. And I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.